I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. Another installment of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Today, health at every size. Is it possible to be both fit and fat? Even if we are carrying a few extra pounds, can we still be metabolically healthy? Nearly 70% of Americans are overweight or obese. That's a lot more of us than in the 1980s. Have we just given up on losing weight? Or have we decided that being big isn't so bad? And what about evidence that suggests healthcare providers have a medical bias against big? Monica Reinagle weighs in on the latest research and answers your questions about the link between weight and health. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall, and it's time for another installment of Smart Nutrition. You know, we'd all like to fit into that pair of pants we wore in college or that dress that was oh so special when we bought it a few years ago. But then life intervenes. A whole lot of us are carrying a bit more weight on our fragile little frames than we would prefer. And statistically, more Americans are obese than ever before. So what about folks who are overweight and whose cholesterol is okay and who have normal blood pressure and whose other health indicators are not worrisome? Well, some experts say that's okay. This idea that you can be fit and fat has informed a movement. It's called the Health at Every Size movement. The nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, is here to talk about this. She is an author and licensed nutritionist. She blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Monica Reinagle, woman of mystery.
Hello,
good
Tom.
To see you.
Nice to be here.
How you doing?
I'm great, thank you.
Good. We will take your calls, your comments, your questions, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. If you don't follow us on Twitter, we can only imagine how ashamed and embarrassed you are. So you can rectify that. Find us there in the Twitter sphere, @MiddayTomHall. So Monica, the first thing I want to talk about is what's the difference between like normal, how do they calculate normal weight versus overweight versus obese versus morbidly obese? I mean, there are categories and there are some distinctions. What are they actually?
Well, we use a metric called body mass index, BMI, which isn't a perfect metric, but it's a really convenient one because you only need to know two things. You need to know how tall you are and you need to know how much you weigh. And from that, we can calculate your weight, according to your size. And that may range anywhere from 18 to over 40, that BMI number. And then we divide up those numbers into categories. So if your BMI is between 18.5 and 25, we consider you to be a normal weight. Between 25 and 29, we consider you to be overweight. Once you hit 30, then you cross over into a territory mm-hmm. we label obese. And then there's even another category over 40 that's very obese. So, you know, this is just a handy way of sorting people, you know, especially when we're looking at big data sets, you know, to try to get a sense of, you know, how is everybody distributed.
So to figure out BMI, you just need your weight and your height.
That's
there are like people at the gym who go around with these little plier things they pinch you on your stomach and they, you know, go in, they mess around with their abacus and they come back out of the room and they say your BMI is X.
You're letting just anybody at the gym do that, Tom?
Well,
or a trainer?
No, these are people who have like the t-shirts with the name of the gym on it.
Okay,
yeah, they have
right.
a name tag. They look like, you know, skilled professionals.
Okay, so now what these guys are doing is they're trying to calculate your body composition, and that's a little bit different. And the calipers or the special scales that you can step on, or sometimes they'll give you some little handles to hold in your hand while you get on the scale, are attempting to see not just your weight, but what percentage of your weight is fat and what percentage of your weight is other stuff like muscle and bone and that, because that's a little bit more of a sophisticated way of estimating. So one of the big criticisms of the BMI as a metric is that if you are really muscular, if you spent a lot of time at that gym, lifting weights, you know, really bodybuilding, your BMI could be in the obese category, according to the numbers, but you're not obese. You're just extremely muscular. You're really heavy for your height. But
that's
you're
my
not,
excuse, and I'm sticking with it.
That's right. I'll back you up.
People
on
wearing
that.
Really dark glasses see me and they think, "Man, that dude is ripped."
Is that why the lights are off in
yeah,
here?
That's right. Exactly.
So that's an attempt to be a little bit more discerning about not just the weight, but you know how it's divided up.
So being overweight is one thing. You know, if you have an excess of fat, if you have an excess of muscle, I mean, is there such thing as an excess of muscle? It probably isn't.
Arguable. So this is, you know, one of the criticisms of BMI is that it might unfairly categorize people as obese when really they're just super, super muscular. But I have to tell you,
that's a pretty small percentage.
You know, that's technically true, but the percentage of people that fall into that category is pretty small.
How about even just the word fat? I mean, the appropriateness, the fairness of that word to describe people who are overweight, and in many instances, admittedly, overweight. I would describe myself right now as fat because I am much heavier than I was 20 years ago. I mean, by a lot. And it drives me nuts that I can't, you know, shed these, you know, 10 pounds or 15 pounds that I'd love to shed. And if I got 15 pounds lower, I would no longer say, I'm certainly overweight, and I think I'm bordering on fat, certainly. Is that just I'm self-critical? Or I mean, what's the deal?
Well, certainly to tell somebody that they're fat has always felt like an insult, you know, not an unkind thing to say, an impolite thing to say. But we have seen in recent years a sort of fat acceptance movement taking root. And people who are overweight are sort of claiming that word and trying to defang it by saying, yeah, I'm fat and I'm happy and I'm beautiful and, you know, and trying to take some of the power out of that word. I think it kind of depends on who's wielding the word and how, but we have seen a movement to try to rehabilitate that. And, you know, I think when we look at a society in which half to three quarters of the adults could be categorized as overweight or obese or fat, you can see why people would start to think like, look, we can't just denigrate the entire population. We need to, you know, recognize that that people can be heavy or fat, whatever word, you know, you feel comfortable with, and still be great people. And maybe, as you started talking about, maybe they can even be healthy. Maybe we should expand our definition of what it means to be healthy.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. It's kind of redolent of the LGBTQ community who have sort of reclaimed the word queer.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that used to be a real
a slur,
mm-hmm. and it's no longer. I mean, There are folks who say, you know, they describe themselves as queer. Interesting. I'd love to hear from listeners who are overweight and happy or unhappy about referring to themselves, thinking about the notion that they are, in fact, fat. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We'd love to hear from all listeners, whether or not you've got weight issues or whether you think one way or the other about weight. You're welcome to join our conversation with Monica Reinagle, our nutrition diva here on Smart Nutrition on Midday. So this health at every size thing, they have a website, there's like a whole thing. You can join it. You can be part of it. They talk about three things. They talk about respect, critical awareness, and compassionate self-care. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're concentrating on. They're not really concentrating on a particular weight per se. I mean, they're basically saying, bodies around the world are diverse. There's all sorts of different kinds, and they're all good. And this has taken hold. I mean, there are a lot of folks in your business, the nutrition business, who are drawn to this, who are supportive of what they're doing. What's your take on it?
I think the reason that people in the nutrition community are embracing it is because they don't want to lose people. And lose the ability to be in dialogue with people. And what we've seen is that, you know, despite this concerted effort over the last couple of decades to get people to lose weight, to address this, you know, we always hear about the obesity epidemic, it's not working. We have not been successful in helping people lose weight in a sustainable way. So we don't want these people to just conclude that there's no point in taking any steps to improve their health, you know. And so I think it's an attempt to stay engaged. You know, we're grappling as a society with the fact that we've identified this as a mortal threat. You know, being overweight is going to take years off our life. We're seeing our population move to the point where, you know, the vast majority of adults are in that category. We don't seem to be able to change it, despite the billions of dollars that are spent on diet and weight loss programs, you know. And I have some ideas about, you know, why that money has been misspent. But, you know, what do we do with that scenario? Perhaps it's time to start working on different behaviors, working on different focuses, because getting people to a healthier weight isn't important. But if we can't do that, let's work on something else. You know, mm-hmm. let's try to improve eating habits. Let's try to get people moving more. Let's try to get people exercising. And if taking the focus off weight loss opens a door for people to go into healthier lifestyles, even, you know, at any size, you know, that may be a win. And, you know, maybe it's a bridge.
Because they say the health at every size folks say that there are ways to evaluate and measure your progress other than just stepping on the scale.
Well, sure.
So they're looking for other, and there are, of course, other factors besides how much you weigh. And how much you weigh has to do with your gender, with your age, with your ethnicity.
Yes.
I mean, it has to do with a whole lot of other things, your genetic factors, all that kind of stuff.
Right. And and there's also this idea that, you know, with a few simple blood tests, we can get a pretty good sense of what's going on inside. You know, what you were referring to as being metabolically healthy. The reason we feel that being overweight is so dangerous is that it increases your risk of heart disease, of stroke, of diabetes,
even
cancer. But there are other risk factors for those diseases. And if those are all normal, then maybe being overweight isn't such a big deal. Now, I have to say, although that has been, you know, sort of a growing philosophy, just last week, a new study was published, came out of the European Heart Journal, that really kind of threw cold water on that and said, like, actually, no. We looked at a big group of people from half a dozen European countries, and we looked at their blood markers and their blood pressure and their blood sugar and their cholesterol, and we looked at their weight, and it turns out that even if your blood numbers are perfect, if you're overweight, you're at advanced, you're at increased risk.
Even with your blood pressure
So it sort of called into question that idea mm-hmm. that you can be overweight but metabolically healthy. In fact, the lead author had a pretty striking statement about this, and she said, "We conclude there is no such thing as being obese and healthy," just, you know, a little harsh.
Yeah. And obese and healthy, maybe people can understand that there's a real dichotomy between those two things. But, you know, 10 pounds, 20 pounds overweight, that's not morbidly obese by any mm-hmm. means for most people. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it may be higher weight than you'd like to have, but if everything else is okay. I mean, we have an email here from John. And I think John speaks for the group, for a lot of people. He says, "I was a three-sport varsity player in high school. And after high school, I ran the Baltimore Marathon 4 times.
Wow.
So there's a guy who obviously is in shape. He's running 26.2 miles 4 times. He says, "I'm 5'10", and I can't get below 190. Mm-hmm. And the scale is foolish." Now, his recommended weight would probably be somewhere like around 180 or so, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 185 given his height. So, and I don't know how old he is, but, you know, here's a guy who has been in shape all of his life, you know, and it's just stubborn. You know, it's just stubborn. Let's go to the phones and sneak in one phone call before we go to the break. Henry in Baltimore, I think you have a similar kind of question. Welcome to Midday with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle.
Hi. So my question is that there's a lot of exercise machines out there and, you know, things like diet pills and diet plans as well. What would be the best way to, I guess, you know, exercise? And how would you, Monica, find a way to motivate yourself to exercise more often? I actually am a diabetic, and I do walk about 20 minutes, a day to kind of get my weight down. But is there a better way to exercise than just, you know, use the exercise machine or diet pills?
All right. Thanks for the call, Henry. So this, you know, there are folks who reach a plateau and can't get any further. When it comes to all of these, vitamin supplements, there's stuff, there's the motivation question, which Henry brings up, and then there's, you know, what specifically can you do? Is walking better than running, or is walking better than doing weight training? Big questions. Give us a little overview, and when we come back for a break, we'll explore them a little more deeply.
Well, I think that exercise, while it can be really valuable, and it can be especially valuable for people who are diabetic, because that 20-minute walk, if you take it right after your meal, can really help keep your blood sugar from being as high as it otherwise would. It's probably never going to be a good weight management strategy. So exercise fits into the healthy eating picture, but it's the long way around the block. You'd have to walk around that block many times to have it start translating into weight loss. So I think we also need to shift, you know, how we conceive of the role of weight loss. The role of exercise
in weight loss.
Weight management. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how about for John's dilemma, which I know is shared by an awful lot of folks, where you get to this point and you just can't seem to drop anymore.
Yeah. Well, without knowing, you know, sort of the whole picture, I think that, you know, being a little bit over your quote-unquote healthy weight when you are fit and healthy. I mean, he doesn't say whether he's still running. Maybe those marathons were the last time he ever laced up his sneakers. But, you know, surely, you know, that's not going to have the same degree of... We can obsess about 5 pounds. That doesn't really make sense. That's not going to have a big impact on your health risks. So there is certainly a common sense factor here. If you're looking at your diet and feeling like it's, you know, you're eating well, you're getting a reasonable amount of exercise, you're 5 pounds over somebody's idea of your ideal weight. Yeah, I don't think I'd lose a whole lot of sleep over that.
All right. Well, don't lose anything between now and 90 seconds when we come back from a break. It's Smart Nutrition Today on Midday with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. She's a licensed nutritionist and a regular contributor to our little show. If you go to her website, overeasy.com, you can sign up for Monica's newsletter and get her nutrition news and tips by email. You can also call her today, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. And again, to join us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Pass the peas. James Brown. You can eat as many peas as you want. It's a vegetable. They're good for you. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday Smart Nutrition. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, it's another installment of Living Questions, our series examining the role of religion in the public sphere. It's a series that we produce in conjunction with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Tomorrow we're going to talk about religion in movies and TV with Stevenson University film professor Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Goucher College religious studies professor Martin Schuster. So give some thoughts about what your favorite religiously themed movie or TV show are, and give us a call. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here. She'll have her review of M. Butterfly at the Everyman Theater. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. As I mentioned, if you've just joined us today, it's Smart Nutrition with our resident nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Monica blogs at nutritionovereasy.com, and we're talking about the health at every size movement and whether or not we can be overweight and healthy. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So one of the things, Monica, that they say on the website for Health at Every Size is they think critical awareness is important. And they say we want to value body knowledge and people's lived experience. They also say that we've lost the war on obesity. They've basically thrown up the white flag here. They're saying fighting fat hasn't made the fat go away, and being thinner, even if we knew how to successfully accomplish it, and they're questioning whether we do, will not necessarily make us healthier or happier. That's interesting to me, because I would think that if you're carrying a few more pounds and you lose a few, that is going to make you happier. But most people are happy about that. Am I missing something there? And it will probably make you a little bit healthier, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you are overweight and you lose that extra weight, you will definitely be improving your risk factors. You're going to be improving your outcomes. You know, that That's pretty clear. Whether you'll be happier or not, I mean, maybe that's kind of like we think that if we win the lottery and have a lot of money, it will solve all our other problems, you know? And I think it's certainly true that, you know, losing weight is not going to make you, you know, love your job if you don't like your job, or, you know, fix all the problems in your life. And maybe it is possible because in our society we are so focused on body size, body image, how we look, that we expect that losing weight will magically solve all of our problems. And obviously that's not true. So, you know, but it's interesting that they feel like one of the biggest arguments on their side is that we've lost the war.
Yeah.
You know, that if you can't beat them, join them, I guess, is the idea. Like, all right, we're never going to be thin again. That ship has sailed. So let's be the healthiest overweight society that we could possibly be. I think that that's better than being in, you know, the unhealthiest overweight society. But I'm not sure that we should question the science showing that maintaining a lower body weight is going to keep us healthier. You know, it's still a good goal. Maybe we should talk about, you know, better ways to get there, you know, and let's certainly do whatever we can where we are right now to improve our health. But I think it's too soon to throw that under the bus as mm-hmm. a worthy goal.
Because they talk about challenging scientific and cultural assumptions. I mean, challenging science is dicey, given that science is science, data is data, mm-hmm. and if it's real, it's real. Now, the cultural assumptions, that's a whole other piece, isn't it?
Yeah. And for sure, there are stereotypes associated with being overweight, you know, and people who are overweight are seen as less industrious and less intelligent and all kinds of other things. They get treated differently in all different kinds of environments. And any stereotype is a cultural assumption worth attacking. So I would say that it is worth looking at the stereotypes that we associate mm-hmm. with being overweight and undermining those.
And one of the environments in which overweight people are experience bias is at the doctor's office.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of data about this, about the way that medical providers mm-hmm. treat people who are overweight versus people who are so-called normal. Right?
Yes, there's numerous studies showing this. And this is a real problem because I don't think that these healthcare providers are being intentionally cruel or negligent, but they have sort of insidious, unconscious biases. They assume that people who are overweight won't take their advice, so they don't bother to give it. They think that they are unwilling or unable to make positive changes in their health, and so they don't bother telling them. You know, they kind of give up on them before they, you know, and so they're sometimes not even likely to tell an overweight patient that they would be healthier if they lost weight, you know, not even to bother giving that advice. But there's a lot of different ways in which people who are overweight don't get the same kind of care.
And part of the issue is that, because I've talked to some doctor friends about this, that when they're dealing with an overweight patient, if they bring up weight, mm-hmm. which is a real
hot
touchy
button.
Subject
yeah.
and hot button for these patients, the patients clam up, you know, they're not receptive to any of the other things that the doctor may suggest in terms of their lifestyle or in terms of specific treatment and specifically addressing some of their issues. So they feel like they got to tread very carefully because they don't want to lose mm-hmm. that line of communication by bringing up this hot button issue that sometimes just has folks close things off.
Right. And I think that this is an area where the Health at Every Size movement has a lot to offer our society by kind of holding up a mirror to those kinds of issues and reminding us that, you know, good, intelligent, valuable people come in all sizes and that we can all be moving in the right direction no matter where we are, you know, at the current moment.
Monica Reinagel, she's the nutrition diva. It's Smart Nutrition here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. The phones are lit up like a Christmas tree. Herbert from Randallstown, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagel. Herbert, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Wanted to make a comment. Ran into the 20-pound problem. I'm 74, been a gym rat most of my life, and each year I gain another pound, and exercise didn't do it. what wound up doing it was the work of Mark Mattson, who's the head of the neuroscience lab at NIH, Department of Aging, also a professor at Hopkins, did work on intermittent fasting. And I've done this for over a year. The 20 pounds is gone, and all the numbers, cholesterol, triglycerides, et cetera, blood sugar, are all down within normal limits.
Very good. Now, how intermittent is your fasting? I mean, how many days a week do you...
3 days a week. I eat dinner the night before, and all eating stops at 7, and then the next day I do not eat until 5 o'clock. So it's 22 hours fasting, and that occurs 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. So you skip breakfast and lunch. You skip breakfast and lunch on 3 days a week. And then
that is correct.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Monica, I mean, what do you think? I mean, God bless Herbert. I mean, it sounds like you've been really successful. You've dropped the 20. I always heard, breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Well, this intermittent fasting has been gaining a lot of traction in the research community. It's difficult for a lot of people to do it, but there are some people for whom it is absolutely not appropriate. But if you're somebody that is a good candidate for this, it is not only a very effective way to manage weight, and sometimes people use a protocol like Herbert is describing, but maybe only once a week instead of three times a week if they're at a weight that they feel like they want to sustain in it, and it helps them to avoid that kind of incremental weight creep. Not only is it a pretty good way of managing weight, especially if you have the support of a healthcare professional who's kind of helping you do it, but as he's suggesting, we see a lot of other beneficial results in things like fasting blood sugar and cholesterol and triglycerides. The body appears to appreciate regular rests from food.
Mm-hmm.
The brain doesn't always appreciate it, but the body seems to. And so, again, not appropriate for everyone, depending if you are diabetic, certainly if you're pregnant, any other number of things are going on, that might not be a good protocol for you. But if you have clearance from your doc to try it and you have the fortitude to experiment with it and see how that's going to work for you. And the other thing I'll say
Clearly our caller does. 3 days a week is a commitment. Yeah.
The other thing I'll say about intermittent fasting, although that can be pretty challenging to go from, 7 o'clock one night till 5 o'clock the next night without eating anything. And, I don't know whether Herbert is still working every day or whether he has the luxury of being able to kind of have a smaller day on that day when he's not eating. But some people find that, as challenging as that might be, easier than cutting back a little bit 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a little bit of
it's a part of it's kind of a personality thing
to get through that one day. But once I get through that one day, then I'm scot-free for the rest of the week. And mm-hmm. so for some people, that's a winning strategy that they can sustain.
Herbert's contention that as he ages, a pound or two a year is not uncommon.
Pretty typical.
Yeah. Carol in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagle.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to ask about the BMI thing, that if an overweight person starts working out, muscle being heavier than fat, their BMI is going to go up, and that's going to be disheartening.
Yeah, this is a well-rehearsed concern in the weight loss community. The truth is that you have to gain an awful lot of muscle. It's difficult to gain as much muscle as it would take to really start moving your BMI up, despite the fact that you're losing fat. It's theoretically possible. I rarely see it actually happening. At most, what we sometimes see happening, and keep in mind, this is not from, lifting a 3-pound barbell and doing 10 sets of bicep curls. This is if you're doing serious weights, heavy weights, to what they call failure, where you could not curl your arm one more time if your life depended on it. That kind of weight, that's what it takes to build that sort of muscle. And if you're doing that and you're also, doing some sort of eating regimen, what may happen is that your weight does not dip, that it seems like you're not losing any weight, but you really are changing your body composition. And then there comes a point at where you kind of catch up with yourself and you start to see the scale going down. But in my personal experience, I've never actually seen somebody gain so much muscle that they were actually gaining weight despite decreases in fat. So again, technically possible, in the real world, almost never happens.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to exercise, there's an upside. I mean, there's a big upside to exercise.
Well, sure. You know, people often say if they start exercising that even though the scale hasn't budged, their clothes are fitting differently. Mm-hmm. You know, they can see that difference. That's great. That's great news. And hopefully, I mean, Carol's question was, wouldn't that be awfully disheartening?
Yeah.
To be working so hard and maybe not seeing the difference on the scale. But I think what gets people through that is they say, yeah, the scale hasn't budged, but, you know, I haven't worn these jeans in 5 years, so I know that I'm making progress, mm-hmm. and that can kind of help keep you in the saddle.
We had a caller, Tim, who couldn't stay on the line, but he had a question that the BMI has been around for 40 years, and they haven't come up with anything better. I mean, are you aware of the fact that they're looking for something else to be the metric?
We do have tons of better tools. They just require a lot more data points, you know. So if you
want, BMI is just convenient.
It's just super convenient. Yeah. And the reason that almost everybody's got a bathroom scale. Everybody knows how tall they are. Their height doesn't change that much from year to year. So it's just a real easy way to get a quick read. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we're using BMI, as I said earlier, to look at these giant data sets. And that's two pieces of data that we always have, where we might not have somebody going through and doing fat caliper measurements or, yeah. you know, different kinds of body composition. Yeah, right. Yeah. So it's just convenient.
And again, BMI, Body Mass Index, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Karen in Baltimore, you're a nurse. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I've been a nurse for 40 years, and I can well attest to the fact that Americans have gotten a lot bigger in the last 40 years just from my own practice and seeing thousands.
Because you're moving around, you're moving them around in the beds too, right?
Oh yeah. My gosh! And I just want to do a PSA. I'm not telling people just have the 10 or 20 pounds, but for the people who are much heavier, it's really harder to take care of you. It's harder to get IVs in you. It's harder for you to mobilize after surgery. So it's not ideal that you're all going to be size 6 or 8, but besides the fact of losing weight to try to, you know, keep some of these health conditions away, if you really have a serious problem with weight, you have to do whatever you can to at least try to lose some weight, because it's just going to impact your health in ways you can't even imagine unless you're a bedside nurse like me. I think two of the reasons are people just don't move around enough. You know, people spend a lot of time just sitting. Portion sizes are huge. And it's true about, I'm an exerciser, I've exercised all my life, but every decade or so I put a little extra weight on, and I just found I had to just keep cutting my portions. I know it's so boring, I don't think I could fast, but I wish there was an easier way to do it. And then at a certain point you have to make peace with the fact that you have a healthy 60-year-old body or a healthy 70-year-old body. It's a reasonable weight, it's not a perfect weight. But you can't collapse into it and just say, oh, it's okay to be 30 pounds overweight, because really it isn't. It's not healthy. I'm looking at purely from health, not from morality or aesthetics.
Sure. Well, thanks for the call, Karen. Appreciate it.
Well, let me just add something else onto Karen's public service announcement. And I think that's really sort of compelling to hear from her that, yeah, if you end up in the hospital, it's going to be harder for her to put your IV in, you know. But here's the other thing. If you are very overweight, if you are obese, you may be looking at, you know, somebody's idea of your target weight and think, I can't lose 100 pounds. It's just never going to happen. And here's something to keep in mind. Losing just 5% of your body weight, so, you know, 10 or 15 pounds if you're very, very overweight, can make a dramatic difference in your health risks, even if you are at that point still.
Yeah, you might even have 80 more pounds to go, but still.
Obese, right. And even if you never go any further, you will have accomplished a great deal. So mm-hmm. just because it's sort of an unimaginable distance that you might have to cross to get yourself into a quote unquote normal range, even 5% can make a gigantic difference. In fact, there was just recently a study that showed that in terms of the improvements in your blood sugar sensitivity and, you know, your disease risks for diabetes and heart disease, the first 5% matters more than any of the rest, you know, no matter, which isn't to say that you need to stop, but don't let, you know, that giant number keep you from taking even a small step in the right direction.
The Talmud says a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Got to start. All right. Monica Reinagle is here. She's the nutrition diva. She's, of course, a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. If you go there, you can sign up for her newsletter, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. By the way, before we take a break, a reminder that coming up next month on Tuesday, October 10th, you can join us in the audience for a live broadcast of Midday at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. We're going to talk about the deindustrialization Organization of Baltimore and the Future of Work. So come to our website, wypr.org/midday, and we'll have a link to reserve a seat. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
And welcome back. It's Midday. If you've just joined us, it's Smart Nutrition Day here on the program. The nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel, is here. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. We're talking about being fit and fat. So, Monica, I want to ask you about an interesting phenomenon that at least was new to me. I think we alluded to it a little bit before, but not by name. And it's called the skinny fat phenomenon. Skinny fat. That's an oxymoron like jumbo shrimp or Tom's intelligence. Just doesn't make sense.
Okay. So earlier we talked about the criticism of the BMI as our sort of benchmark, in that if you had somebody who was super muscular, they could have a BMI that made them look obese, but they would actually be very fit. Well, this is kind of the inverse situation, where somebody has a normal BMI, they're right smack in the target zone. If their doctor were just kind of looking at their chart, they'd say, well, that's perfect, no need to work on that. And yet, they actually have a high proportion of fat, often in the middle, kind of around their internal organs, the most dangerous kind of fat to have, and very low kind of muscle tone and muscle mass and skeletal muscle. And that's why their BMI can be normal, but they are actually at elevated risk as if they were overweight. You know, all of that extra visceral fat that they're carrying, sort of invisibly, is elevating their risk of heart disease and diabetes, but they're sort of slipping through the cracks because they look like they're normal weight. And you know, that is the benchmark that we use to kind of screen people out to see whether they are quote unquote healthy or not. That's a real thing. And it's a much more potent criticism of the body mass index as a benchmark, because unlike our hypothetical weightlifter whose BMI makes him obese, but he's great, the skinny fat phenomenon is far more common.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a real thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it goes to what Karen, our nurse, was talking about a little bit. You know, this reflects a very sedentary society. We are not moving our bodies. We're sitting at desks looking at computer screens. So we have very low muscle tone. And that can kind of mask the fact that we are actually carrying a dangerous amount of fat.
Lily in Hancock, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This kind of has to do with the last caller, the nurse who was begging people to lose weight. I was wondering if you or any of your guests had heard of, I forget where they were done, but there were some studies done that showed that doctors who cared for overweight patients didn't give the same quality of care to overweight patients as they did to thinner patients, and that often they would overlook symptoms of a more serious disease and they would just tell the patients just to lose weight before they would even consider anything else. And patients who would go in for something completely unrelated and would be told to lose weight. And I was wondering if you or any of your guests would be able to comment on that. And
all right. Well,
I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Lily. We talked a little bit about, you know, general bias that doctors may have towards people who are overweight. Certainly society as a whole has that bias. I mean, you know, it is kind of ironic, isn't it, that we seem to be obsessed with thinness, yet here we are, live in a country where nearly 70% of us are overweight.
I think that if you were to sit any physician down and say, you know, how would you treat somebody that came in, you know, who was overweight, you know, what kind of tests would you order, you'd get a very reasonable, compassionate, wonderful response. But when you actually look at medical records, you know, across, we can see a trend emerging that people who go in who are overweight, they don't order the same tests. They don't screen them as carefully. They may be assuming that, all of their complaints that they're coming in with, you know, are just due to the obvious problem that's sitting in front of them, that they just need to lose weight and not dig any deeper. That it's, you know, it's unfortunate. And again, I don't think that any of our healthcare providers are uncompassionate people. I think this is an unconscious bias that sets up, but it is something that we've observed. It's definitely something that we need to work on. I can tell you from personal experience that this is a hot topic at medical and nutrition conferences, you know, in terms of our training, our continuing medical education and nutrition education to try to make healthcare providers more conscious of this so that we can fight against that unconscious bias.
Lawrence in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. Thanks for your call.
Hi. I guess I'm what you'd call a success story because when I turned 65, my doctor, I was 200 pounds, which was up from about 150 when I quit running when I was 45, and my doctor warned me about my blood sugar. But what he didn't do was really give me any kind of a plan. But I developed my own, and I dropped in 9 months to, I lost 40 pounds and then another 10 pounds later. But my question is, what do you think about what we call food in this country? Because when you go into a Sam's Club or a food store, what you see everywhere are these high calorie snacks and high calorie prepared foods. And if we could educate people more on, because I don't think exercise lost the weight. I think it was dieting. It's basically salads all the time.
Because I think, you know, Lawrence, folks hear your story and they say, wow, 40 pounds in 9 months. Sign me up, you know. So can you give us a quick overview of how you accomplished that? I mean, obviously you did some exercise, but what did you, was it a matter of cutting things out of your diet or adding things that hadn't been?
Well, it was a matter of desperation because I'd never seriously dieted before. I did stop eating breakfast, which, you know, everybody tells you it's the most important meal of the day. But I felt that it was an extra 500 calories that I could do without. And I found I didn't hurt my energy level. And when I first started running again, and I ran for an hour in the afternoon, I would be so tired I had to lay down. But now I can run in the morning and have energy all day. My weight's about 152. And I've been working out in the gym for the last 16 months. I just turned 74 last week. But the salads that I ate had a lot of food in it, but it didn't have many calories. I ate a lot of celery. I really paid attention to calories. I used non-fat mayonnaise, which Kraft makes a decent tasting one. And I happen to like mayonnaise. I didn't eat
Okay. Well, thanks, Lawrence. We are losing your phone, the phone connection there, but I appreciate it. I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, but there's so many people, I think, who try something very similar to what Lawrence has tried and don't succeed.
Well, and, you know, Lawrence is right that, you know, doctors who may look at you and say, hey, you really need to take off some weight, then don't have a whole lot to offer in terms of advice. You know, they don't consider it really their field. You know, that's what dietitians are for. And so often you're left to your own devices. And it sounds like Lawrence, under his own steam, you know, found his way to something that worked. And also sounds like he has a great deal of self-discipline. Something about that doctor's visit certainly got his attention. And that's what, to go back to a question that was a half an hour ago, that's where he found that motivation, because I'm sure that that did not happen without, you know, a fair amount of self-control. So he was very motivated to change the situation, and he did. But surely, you know, the environment that we live in and the foodscape, as we sometimes call it, is part of how we got here. We are surrounded by food all the time. The food is very caloric. It's very tempting. It's very, you know, delicious, you know, and it's hard to avoid. And we build a lot of our social time around food. And that's a big part of the reason why we have all steadily gained weight over the decades. And it takes a lot of conscious intervention to withstand that.
And we talk about this all the time. The less prepared foods we eat, the better off we are. If we eat something that our grandmothers or great grandmothers used to cook, rather than stuff that is, you know, in a package wrapped in plastic, it's probably going to be all right.
Well, he said something very interesting. He said he started eating salads and there was a lot of food in the bowl, but not a lot of calories. And that's exactly right. You know, mm-hmm. when we start eating more vegetables, more less processed foods, you actually can eat more, but you're taking in fewer calories. And, yeah. and that can be the road to success, obviously.
Bob sends us an email from Pasadena. He says, I'm technically, no, actually obese, 5'6 and 230 pounds. I also have healthy, low cholesterol, good blood pressure, sugar levels are good. I do 30 minutes of exercise every day or so. I'm almost 60 and I take nothing except a daily vitamin, and I see a doctor every year just to be sure. I don't think this is too unusual, Bob writes. He says, I think folks get tired of the stuff that the experts keep putting out.
I'm so glad to hear all of that good news, that the cholesterol is good, blood pressure, blood sugar, that's fantastic. And certainly, Bob is infinitely better off with that kind of a health report and doing his exercise than he would be if those things were not the case. However, the data that we show see that even in that scenario that he's describing, the mere fact that he's carrying that extra, you know, 60 pounds, 75 pounds, does increase his risk of heart disease by about a third. Does that mean that he will get heart disease? I fervently hope not. And of course, you know, statistics are not predictive. But better to be fit and fat than unfit and fat. Best of all, to be fit and, you know, normal weight. But we'll take what we can get.
Yeah. Robin in Baltimore, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my call. My question is about the weight that is added on due to prescription medications. I'm 5 feet tall, small frame. I now weigh 135, and I was used to weighing about 115 after having had two children. I cannot get this weight, and it's a different kind of weight also. What can be done about that?
That's a good question, Robin, and I'm sure it's shared by many folks. Thanks
for
the call.
It's a tough one, and it is common that people will need to start taking a medication, and this can be an unwanted side effect. And it kind of depends on what medication is to blame. If it's a medication that's causing you to retain water, then, you know, it is one kind of a solution. And actually, you know, carrying a little extra water weight, although it's kind of a bummer, is not a health risk, you know. And if it's the kind of medication that increases your appetite, and so you are either eating more or you're hungry all the time, that's a little trickier. So it kind of depends on, or if it's a medication that changes the balance of hormones in your body, that can be, you know, changing your metabolism. So the solution depends a little bit on what that medication is. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's an unintended side effect that we have to accept because the medication is so necessary. I wouldn't say there's nothing to be done about it, but I can certainly recognize that there are times when that is pernicious, very difficult to deal with, but it helps to know kind of what the cause is.
Just have about a minute left, Monica. There's a piece in the New York Times Magazine last month, and they talked about the folks at Weight Watchers wondering why fewer people were signing up for Weight Watchers. Mm-hmm. And so they did some polling and stuff, and they found that folks thought that dieting was considered tacky, it's anti-feminist, it's arcane, in the new millennium, all bodies should be accepted. So dieting as a thing is sort of perhaps fading. Healthy living is in the ascendance. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I don't think dieting was helping. The dieter's mindset was not getting us where we needed to go. There were a lot of downsides to it. So I'm not sad to see us moving away from dieting as the way we've been doing it as a solution. But I don't want us to, you know, abandon hope of moving towards a healthy body weight.
There's always hope. All right. Thanks, Monica. I appreciate it. And I hope you will be back in a month or two.
Thanks,
Tom.
Good
to see you. Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Come on over to wipr.org/midday and we'll give you a link to sign up for Monica's newsletter. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Living Questions, our monthly series examining the role of religion in the public sphere. Tomorrow, a conversation about religion in movies and TV. Filmmaker and Stevenson University professor Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Goucher College Religious Studies professor Martin Schuster are going to join me, as will theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's going to review M. Butterfly at the Everyman Theater. So I hope you can join us tomorrow here on Midday. Lunch today was provided operated by the Baltimore Chef Shop. They're on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, they're offering a couples cooking class on Thai street food. We'll have more on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your calls, your emails, your tweets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.